You're connected to the Cricket and Seagull Fireside Chat Podcast. This week, the Declaration of Independence. Happy 4th of July, with moments from the lives of two of the founders of our country. With
principles is the philosophical foundation for our government. And to the extent that we try to redefine that, we will be acting contrary to the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God, and we will see the consequences. And I think we have seen the consequences. Well, let me give you an example. I think at a theoretical level, this is sometimes hard for people of different faiths to grasp, but let's talk about separation of church and state for a minute. Thomas Jefferson said those words in a letter to the Danbury Baptists, 1802. This is one of the reasons why I think that we view the Declaration of Independence so differently today than we used to, because there's been a secular shift away from the true and original interpretation of the First Amendment, which of course allows and provides not for the separation of church and state, but for, well, the language of the First Amendment is that Congress shall make no law establishing, right, religion, nor prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Those are two clauses, the establishment clause and the free exercise clause.
There is no separation clause.
There's no separation clause. So in 1802, Jefferson writes this letter to the Danbury Baptists, and they're concerned because, you know, they're afraid that the political climate of the day is going to somehow inhibit their free exercise of religion. Jefferson responds by saying that when it comes to establishment, there needs to be a separation of church and state. Well, that was 1802. Fast forward 150 years approximately, 1947, we have Justice Hugo Black in this case called Everson versus Board of Education, Supreme Court Justice. And he is interpreting the First Amendment and the Free Exercise Clause and the Establishment Clause. And he starts talking about the separation of church and state. He says the separation of church and state means that there should be no preference by the federal government and federal courts and government in general for one religion in favor of another, and so far so good, that's fine, and that the government should not establish a religion, still so far so good. But then in that same sentence, he used some very unfounded and frankly dangerous language. He said, nor favoritism for religion over irreligion. Did you catch that? He started by saying the First Amendment means, according to Jefferson and others who have interpreted it, that there shouldn't be establishment, there shouldn't be preference for one religion over another, and that there shouldn't be a preference for religion over irreligion. That was a fatal flaw in reasoning, and it was unfounded in history or original intent, including by Jefferson, that the First Amendment or that the Declaration and the guiding philosophy of our country ever contemplated that we would not favor religion over irreligion, over non-religion. That's where we have gone astray. You know, it was Adams who said that our Constitution was made for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to any other. You know, the moment we start to discard the founding philosophy of the Declaration, that we exist as a result of a creator God, that the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God guide good law and good policy. And the moment we start to believe statements like Hugo Black's, that government ought not to favor religion over irreligion, is the moment we start to separate us from our identity.
Those original philosophical statements that underpin the Constitution that exist
exactly
in the Declaration.
The Constitution of the United States is one of only 17 constitutions in the world that exist still in its original form. All others are new since something like 1940. Its staying power, its strength, its purity, its truthfulness, its adherence to the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God are truly extraordinary, are truly divine. And the moment that we start to separate ourselves and our laws from that guiding philosophy in the Declaration, which of course was implemented by the Constitution, is the moment that we put that first crack in the foundation of the greatness of America.
More with Grant Beckwith and the Declaration of Independence, including little-known moments in the lives of George Washington and John Adams, when The Cricket and Seagull returns, after this message from our brand new sponsor. Come
follow me. Hymns that inspire, hymns that uplift and glorify. LDS Hymns of Praise and LDS Hymns of Worship are now available in a 2-CD set from PositiveMusicAndDownloads.com. Purchase this inspiring 40-song collection for just $15.95. Log on to PositiveMusicAndDownloads.com and let these songs bring the spirit of worship into your home.
This fall, come visit Palmyra, Kirtland, Independence, and Nauvoo. Join me, Stephen Cap Perry, and my wife, Joanne, for our annual LDS Church History Fall Conference Tour. Visit StephenCapPerry.com for a detailed itinerary. While there, you'll also see a link to our upcoming Christmas in Israel trip, leaving the day after Christmas and ringing in the New Year in Jerusalem. It all fits neatly into the break between school semesters. Details at StephenCapPerry.com. We'd love to travel and explore church history with you. You're connected to the Cricket and Seagull Fireside Chat. Now more on the Declaration of Independence with Grant Beckwith.
As an educator, you've also seen how this has changed even the stories that are included in textbooks. Besides reminding everyone that on the 4th of July with parades and hot dogs and red, white, and blue, it might not hurt to read the Declaration of Independence reread and get a reminder, a little refresher on those undergirding philosophies. But I wonder if you'd share a couple of these stories, things that used to be even in school textbooks but have gone the way of all things, partly because of their religious content.
I'd be happy to. There's a great piece of history that used to be included in virtually all of America's textbooks, carried this story of Washington being protected by divine providence when he was the colonel of the Virginia militia.
So this is before the Revolutionary War.
Yes, the story of Washington predated the Revolutionary War. He was Colonel Washington of the Virginia Militia, not Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army. So this is when he was younger. He was in his 20s. This is during the French and Indian War. The date is 1755. The British and the Americans are allies at this point in the French and Indian War. The Americans and the British are trying to get rid of the French and the Indians with respect to disputes over land. Washington is 23 years old, I think, and he's this wonderfully brilliant colonel, and he's asked by the British to help with a force of 2,300 British. Washington had something like 100 of his buckskin Virginia militia, and he was going to help the British get up to Fort Duquesne, which is now in Pittsburgh. 2,300 British, some Virginia militiamen, and Colonel Washington, General Braddock, they split the 2,300 up into two companies. So Washington had about 1,300 of these men, most of whom were British. They got about 7 miles out of Pittsburgh, of Fort Duquesne, and the Indians and the French had staged an ambush in a ravine. British, of course, were taught to march shoulder to shoulder. We see this kind of warfare and think today how just utterly ridiculous that is. But as they were marching through this ravine, the Indians, hiding behind trees and rocks and everything else, opened fire. There were 86 captains, colonels on horseback. Of course, in warfare, you try to shoot the leaders first, and of the 1,300 total in this company that Washington was leading, over 700 were killed in a two-hour time span in this ravine. So well over half. And of the 86 who were on horseback, all of them, except for one, Colonel Washington, had their horses shot out from under them or were killed. George Washington somehow escapes this thing alive, makes his way back to a fort in Maryland, and from there writes a letter to his mother and to his brother. And he says to them, you know, something to the effect of, by all dispensations of providence, I have been protected beyond all expectation by the hand of God, and indicates that he had 4 bullet holes in his vest, none of which pierced his skin. And the story goes on because something like 15 years later, the Indian chief who was responsible for the massacre, for the ambush, finds Washington again. And the Indian chief says to George Washington, I have been seeking that general whom the Great Spirit protected in war. The Indian chief went on to explain that he shot personally 17 times, almost at point blank, at Washington, and could not fell him from his horse. So, and I've actually got, would you like to hear some of the words of this chief?
Sure.
Okay. So he says, "I am a chief and ruler over my tribes. My influence extends to the waters of the Great Lakes and to the far Blue Mountains. I have traveled a long and weary path that I might see the young warrior of the great battle. It was on the day when the white man's blood mixed with the streams of our forest that I first beheld this chief, Washington. I called to my young men and said, 'Mark yon tall and daring warrior. He is not of the Redcoat tribe. He hath an Indian's wisdom, and his warriors fight as we do. Himself is alone exposed. Quick, let your aim be certain, and he dies.' Our rifles were leveled, rifles which, but for you, knew not how to miss. 'Twas all in vain. A power mightier far than we shielded you. Seeing you were under the special guardianship of the Great Spirit, we immediately ceased to fire at you. I am old and soon shall be gathered to the great council fire of my fathers in the land of shades. But ere I go, there is something bids me speak in the voice of prophecy. Listen, the Great Spirit protects that man," and he pointed to Washington, "and guides his destinies. He will become the chief of nations, and a people yet unborn will hail him as the founder of a mighty empire. I am come to pay homage to the man who is the particular favorite of heaven and who can never die in battle." So, and this was in textbooks. This was in, because of course it's a wonderfully powerful example of the foreordination, if you will, not only of Washington, but of the place of America in world history by a supreme being. There were actually multiple accounts of this. There was another one by a young woman who was captured by the Shawnee Indians. She heard the Shawnee Indians talking about this chief who could not be shot off his horse at the same time. So this was, you know, 17, I guess it would have been 1770-ish, right around there. And she came back and told the whole story to her town. And there was even a preacher who shared this story about General Washington, the Shawnee Indians, saying they couldn't kill him. It wasn't the only time when Washington and others were literally protected by a divine hand. There was a British officer who told his story about seeing Washington and having the opportunity to kill Washington. And yet, for whatever reason, he lowered his rifle and could not do it. So, yeah, books have been written about this. David Barton is one who does a great job of writing on this particular topic. It's sometimes referred to as the Bulletproof Washington story. You could find materials about that. But that's one. It's not carried in textbooks anymore, in part because it's so overtly religious. And that, of course, is a difficult story to tell in a textbook without getting into conversations that are sometimes uncomfortable in the prevailing classroom atmosphere. The other story is also about one of our founders, John Adams, the second president now, and when he was young as well, when he was in his 20s. John Adams went to Harvard University. Harvard was a seminary at the time. It had an overtly Christian and religious mission. This is the summer of 1756. So Adams was 20 years old at the time. He was really struggling about what to do with his future. At the time, he was discontent with himself, his present state of existence. He was prone to daydreaming. He felt like he constantly formed but never really executed good resolutions. And in his journal, he even wrote, "Oh, that I could wear out my mind every mean and base affectation, conquer my natural pride and conceit." So he was really uncomfortable with his state of existence at the time. He even vowed to quit chewing tobacco. I mean, it's one of those moments that we all go through where we're just really trying to purge from ourselves all unholy things and become a better person. Adams, being the prolific diarist that he was, and Abigail, his later wife, also so wonderful at writing in their diaries, and so we have so much wonderful material from them. He said in his journal, he said, so this was 1756, July 21st, he said, "I am resolved to rise with the sun and to study scriptures on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday mornings, and to study some Latin author the other three mornings. Noons and nights, I intend to read English authors. I will rouse up my mind and fix my attention. I will stand collected within myself and think upon what I read and what I see. I will strive with all."